This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Greatest Story Ever Told, So Far. Why Are We Here? Written and performed by Lawrence M. Krauss. This audiobook includes a PDF of the images that accompanied the print edition. If you have purchased an audio CD version, look for the PDF on a separate disc. It appears as an additional file if you have purchased an MP3 CD or an MP3 download version. For Nancy. These are the tears of things, and the stuff of our mortality cuts us to the heart. Virgil. Prologue. The hardest thing of all to see is what is really there. J. A. Baker, The Peregrine. In the beginning, there was light. But more than this, there was gravity. After that, all hell broke loose. This is how the story of the greatest intellectual adventure in history might properly be introduced. It is a story of science's quest to uncover the hidden realities underlying the world of our experience, which required marshaling the very pinnacle of human creativity and intellectual bravery on an unparalleled global scale. This process would not have been possible without a willingness to dispense with all kinds of beliefs and preconceptions and dogma, scientific and otherwise. The story is filled with drama and surprise. It spans the full arc of human history, and most remarkably, the current version isn't even the final one. Just another working draft. It's a story that deserves to be shared far more broadly. Already in the first world, parts of this story are helping to slowly replace the myths and superstitions that more ignorant societies found solace in centuries or millennia ago. Nevertheless, thanks to the directors George Stevens and David Lean, the Judeo-Christian Bible is still sometimes referred to as the greatest story ever told. This characterization is astounding, because even allowing for the frequent sex and violence, and a bit of poetry in the Psalms, the Bible as a piece of literature arguably does not compare well to the equally racy but less violent Greek and Roman epics such as the Aeneid or the Odyssey, even if the English translation of the Bible has served as a model for many subsequent books. Either way, as a guide for understanding the world, the Bible is pathetically inconsistent and outdated. And one might legitimately argue that as a guide for human behavior, large swaths of it border on the obscene. In science, the very word sacred is profane. No ideas, religious or otherwise, get a free pass. For this reason, the pinnacle of the human story did not conclude with a prophet's sacrifice 2,000 years ago any more than it did with the death of another prophet 600 years later. The story of our origins and our future is a tale that keeps on telling. And the story is getting more interesting all the time, not due to revelation, but due to the steady march of scientific discovery. Contrary to many popular perceptions, the scientific story also encompasses both poetry and a deep spirituality. But this spirituality has the additional virtue of being tied to the real world, and not created in large part to appease our hopes and dreams. The lessons of our exploration into the unknown, led not by our desires, but by the force of experiment, are humbling. 500 years of science have liberated humanity from the shackles of enforced ignorance. By this standard, what cosmic arrogance lies at the heart of the assertion that the universe was created so that we could exist? What myopia lies at the heart of the assumption that the universe of our experience is characteristic of the universe throughout all of space and time? This anthropocentrism has fallen by the wayside as a result of the story of science. What replaces it? Have we lost something in the process? Or, as I shall argue, have we gained something even greater? I once said at a public event that the business of science is to make people uncomfortable. I briefly regretted the remark because I worried that it would scare people away. But being uncomfortable is a virtue, not a hindrance. Everything about our evolutionary history has primed our minds to be comfortable with concepts that helped us survive, such as the natural teleological tendency children have to assume objects exist to serve a goal, and the broader tendency to anthropomorphize, to assign agency to lifeless objects. Because clearly, it is better to mistake an inert object for a threat than a threat for an inert object. Evolution didn't prepare our minds to appreciate long or short timescales, or short or huge distances that we cannot experience directly. So it is no wonder that some of the remarkable discoveries of the scientific method, such as evolution and quantum mechanics, are non-intuitive at best, and can draw most of us well outside our myopic comfort zone. This is also what makes the greatest story ever told so worth telling. The best stories challenge us. They cause us to see ourselves differently, to realign our picture of ourselves and our place in the cosmos. This is not only true for the greatest literature, music, and art. It is true of science as well. In this sense, it is unfortunate that replacing ancient beliefs with modern scientific enlightenment is so often described as a loss of faith. How much greater is the story our children will be able to tell than the story we have told? Surely, that is the greatest contribution of science to civilization, to ensure that the greatest books are not those of the past, but of the future. Every epic story has a moral. In ours, we find that letting the cosmos guide our minds through empirical discovery can produce a great richness of spirit that harnesses the best of what humanity has to offer. It can give us hope for the future by allowing us to enter it with our eyes open and with the necessary tools to actively participate in it. My previous book, A Universe from Nothing, described how the revolutionary discoveries of the past 100 years have changed the way we understand our evolving universe on its largest scales. This change has led science to begin to directly address the question, why is there something rather than nothing? Which was formerly religious territory, and rework it into something less solipsistic and operationally more useful. Like A Universe from Nothing, this story also originated in a lecture I presented, in this case at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., which generated some excitement at the time, and as a result, I was once again driven to elaborate upon the ideas I started to develop there. In contrast to A Universe from Nothing, in this book, I explore the other end of the spectrum of our knowledge, and its equally powerful implications for understanding age-old questions. The profound changes over the past 100 years in the way we understand nature at its smallest scales are allowing us to similarly co-opt the equally fundamental question, why are we here? We will find that reality is not what we think it is. Under the surface are weird, counterintuitive, invisible inner workings that can challenge our preconceptions of what makes sense, as much as a universe arising from nothing might. And like the conclusion I drew in my last book, the ultimate lesson from the story I will tell here is that there is no obvious plan or purpose to the world we find ourselves living in. Our existence was not preordained, but appears to be a curious accident. We teeter on a precarious ledge, with the ultimate balance determined by phenomena that lie well beneath the surface of our experience. Phenomena that don't rely in any way upon our existence. In this sense, Einstein was wrong. God does appear to play dice with the universe, or universes. So far we've been lucky. But like playing at the craps table, our luck may not last forever. Humanity took a major step toward modernity when it dawned in our ancestors' consciousness that there is more to the universe than meets the eye. This realization was probably not accidental. We appear to be hardwired to need a narrative that transcends and makes sense of our own existence, a need that was probably intimately related to the rise of religious belief in early human societies. By contrast, the story of the rise of modern science and its divergence from superstition is the tale of how the hidden realities of nature were uncovered by reason and experiment through a process in which seemingly disparate, strange, and sometimes threatening phenomena were ultimately understood to be connected just beneath the visible surface. Ultimately, these connections dispel the goblins and fairies that had earlier spawned among our ancestors. The discovery of connections between otherwise seemingly disparate phenomena is, more than any other single indicator, the hallmark of progress in science. The many classic examples include Newton's connection of the orbit of the moon to a falling apple, Galileo's recognition that vastly different observed behaviors for falling objects obscure that they are actually attracted to the Earth's surface at the same rate, and Darwin's epic realization that the diversity of life on Earth could arise from a single progenitor by the simple process of natural selection. None of these connections was all that obvious at first. However, after the relationship comes to light and becomes clear, it prompts an aha experience of understanding and familiarity. One feels like saying, "I should have thought of that." Our modern picture of nature at its most fundamental scale, the standard model, as it has become called, contains an embarrassment of riches, connections that are far removed from the realm of everyday experience. So far removed that it is impossible without some grounding to make the leap in one step to visualize them. Not surprisingly, such a single leap never occurred historically either. A series of remarkable and unexpected and seemingly unrelated connections emerged to form the coherent picture we now have. The mathematical architecture that has resulted is so ornate that it almost seems arbitrary. Aha is usually the furthest thing from the lips of the non-initiated when they hear about the Higgs boson or grand unification of the forces of nature. To move beyond the surface layers of reality, we need a story that connects the world we know with the deepest corners of the invisible world all around us. We cannot understand that hidden world with intuitions based solely on direct sensation. That is the story I want to tell here. I will take you on a journey to the heart of those mysteries that lie at the edge of our understanding of space, time, and the forces that operate within them. My goal is not to unnecessarily provoke or offend, but to prod you, just as we physicists ourselves have been prodded and dragged by new discoveries into a new reality that is at once both uncomfortable and uplifting. Our most recent discoveries about nature's fundamental scales have chillingly altered our perceptions of the inevitability of our presence in the universe. They provide evidence, too, that the future will no doubt be radically different from what we might otherwise have imagined. And they, too, further decrease our cosmic significance. We might prefer to deny this uncomfortable, inconvenient reality, this impersonal, apparently random universe, but if we view it in another context, all of this need not be depressing. A universe without purpose, which is the way it is as far as I can tell, is far more exciting than one designed just for us, because it means that the possibilities of existence are so much more diverse and far-ranging. How invigorating it is to find ourselves with an exotic menagerie to explore, with laws and phenomena that previously seemed beyond our wildest dreams, and to attempt to untangle the knotted confusion of experience and to search for some sense of order beneath. And how fascinating it is to discover that order and to piece together a coherent picture of the universe on scales far beyond those that we may ever directly experience. A picture woven together by our ability to predict what will happen next and the consequent ability to control the environment around us. How lucky to have our brief moment in the sun. Every day that we discover something new and surprising, the story gets even better. Part 1. Genesis. Chapter 1. From the Armoire to the Cave. The simple inherit folly, but the prudent are crowned with knowledge. Proverbs, chapter 14. Verse 18. In my beginning, there was light. Surely there was light at the beginning of time, but before we can get to the beginning of time, we will need to explore our own beginnings, which also means exploring the beginning of science. And that means returning to the ultimate motive for both science and religion, the longing for something else, something beyond the universe of our experience. For many people, that longing translates into something that gives meaning and purpose to the universe and extends to a longing for some hidden place that is better than the world in which we live, where sins are forgiven, pain is absent, and death does not exist. Others, however, long for a hidden place of a very different sort, the physical world beyond our senses, the world that helps us understand how things behave the way they do rather than why. This hidden world underlies what we experience, and the understanding of it gives us the power to change our lives, our environment, and our future. The contrast between these two worlds is reflected in two very different works of literature. The first, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis, is a 20th century children's fantasy with decidedly religious overtones. It captures a childhood experience most of us have had, looking under the bed or in the closet or in the attic for hidden treasure or evidence that there's more out there than what we normally experience. In the book, several school children discover a strange new world, Narnia, by climbing into a large wardrobe in the country house outside London where they've been sequestered for their protection during the Second World War. The children help save Narnia with the aid of a lion who lets himself be humiliated and sacrificed, Christ-like, at an altar in order to conquer evil in his world. While the religious allusion in Lewis's story is clear, we can also interpret it in another way, as an allegory, not for the existence of God or the devil, but rather for the remarkable and potentially terrifying possibilities of the unknown, possibilities that lie just beyond the edge of our senses, just waiting for us to be brave enough to seek them out, possibilities that, once revealed, may enrich our understanding of ourselves or, for some who feel a need, provide a sense of value and purpose. The portal to a hidden world inside the wardrobe is at once safe, with the familiar smell of off-worn clothes, and mysterious. It implies the need to move beyond classical notions of space and time. For if nothing is revealed to an observer who is in front of or behind the wardrobe, and something is revealed only to someone inside, then the space experienced inside the wardrobe must be far larger than that seen from its outside. Such a concept is characteristic of a universe in which space and time can be dynamical, as in the general theory of relativity, where, for example, from outside the event horizon of a black hole, that radius inside of which there is no escape, a black hole might appear to comprise a small volume. But if for an observer inside, who has not yet been crushed to smithereens by the gravitational forces present, the volume can look quite different. Indeed, it is possible, though beyond the domain where we can perform reliable calculations, that the space inside a black hole might provide a portal to another universe disconnected from our own. But the central point I want to return to is that the possibility of universes beyond our perception seems to be tied, in the literary and philosophical imagination at least, to the possibility that space itself is not what it seems. The harbinger of this notion, the Ur story, if you will, was written 23 centuries before Lewis penned his fantasy. I refer to Plato's Republic, and in particular to my favorite section, the allegory of the cave. But in spite of its early provenance, it illuminates more directly and more clearly both the potential necessity and the potential perils of searching for understanding beyond the reach of our immediate senses. In the allegory, Plato likens our experience of reality to that of a group of individuals who live their lives entirely imprisoned inside a cave, forced to face a blank wall. Their only view of the real world is that wall, which is illuminated by a fire behind them, and on which they see shadows moving. The shadows come from objects located behind them that the light of the fire projects on the wall. I show the drawing in the provided PDF 1A, which came from the high school text in which I first read this allegory, in a 1961 translation of Plato's Dialogues. The drawing is amusing because it clearly reflects as much about the time it was drawn as does the configuration of the cave described in the dialogue. Why, for example, are the prisoners here all women, and scantily clad ones at that? In Plato's day, any sexual allusion might easily have displayed young boys. Plato argues that the prisoners will view the shadows as reality, and even give them names. This is not unreasonable, and it is, in one sense, as we shall soon see, a very modern view of what reality is, namely that which we can directly measure. My favorite definition of reality still is that given by the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, who said, "Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away." For the prisoners, the shadows are what they see. They are also likely to hear only the echoes of noises made behind them as the sounds bounce off the wall. Plato likened a philosopher to a prisoner who is freed from bondage and forced, almost against his will, to not only look at the fire, but to move past it and out to the daylight beyond. First, the poor soul will be in distress, with the glare of the fire and the sunshine beyond the cave hurting his eyes. Objects will appear completely unfamiliar. They will not resemble their shadows. Plato argues that the new free man may still imagine the shadows that he is used to as truer representations than the objects themselves that are casting the shadows. If the individual is reluctantly dragged out into the sunshine, ultimately, all of these sensations of confusion and pain will be multiplied. But eventually, he will become accustomed to the real world, will see the stars and the moon and sky, and his soul and mind will be liberated of the illusions that had earlier governed his life. If the person returns to the cave, Plato argues, two things would happen. First, because his eyes would no longer be accustomed to the darkness, he would be less able to distinguish the shadows and recognize them, and his compatriots would view him as handicapped at best and dim at worst. Second, he would no longer view the petty and myopic priorities of his former society or the honors given to those who might best recognize the shadows and predict their future as worthy of his respect. As Plato poetically put it, quoting from Homer, "Better to be the poor servant of a poor master and to endure anything rather than think as they do and live after their manner." So much for those whose lives are lived entirely in illusion, which Plato suggests include most of humanity. Then the allegory states that the journey upward into the light is the ascent of the soul into the intellectual world. Clearly, in Plato's mind, only a retreat to the purely intellectual world, a journey reserved for the few, aka philosophers, could replace illusion with reality. Happily, that journey is far more accessible today using the techniques of science, which combine reason and reflection with empirical inquiry. Nevertheless, the same challenge remains for scientists today, to see what is behind the shadows, to see that which, when you drop your preconceptions, doesn't disappear. While Plato doesn't explicitly mention it, not only would his fellow prisoners view the poor soul who had ventured out and returned as handicapped, but they would likely think he was crazy if he talked about the wonders that he had glimpsed. The sun, the moon, lakes, trees, and other people and their civilizations. This idea is strikingly modern. As the frontiers of science have moved further and further away from the world of the familiar and the world of common sense, as inferred from our direct experience, our picture of the reality underlying our experience is getting increasingly difficult for us to comprehend or accept. Some find it more comforting to retreat to myth and superstition for guidance. But we have every reason to expect that common sense, which first evolved to help us cope with predators in the savannas of Africa, might lead us astray when we attempt to think about nature on vastly different scales. We didn't evolve to intuitively understand the world of the very small, the very big, or the very fast. We shouldn't expect the rules we have come to rely on for our daily lives to be universal. While that myopia was useful from an evolutionary perspective, as thinking beings we can move beyond it. In this regard, I cannot resist quoting one last admonition in Plato's allegory. Quote, "In the world of knowledge, the idea of good appears last of all and is seen only with an effort, and, when seen, is also inferred to be the author of all things good and right, parent of light, and the immediate source of reason and truth." End quote. Plato further argues that this is what those who would act rationally should strive for in both public and private life. Seeking the good by focusing on reason and truth. He suggests that we can only do so by exploring the realities that underlie the world of our direct experience, rather than by exploring the illusions of a reality that we might want to exist. Only through rational examination of what is real, and not by faith alone, is rational action, or good, possible. Today, Plato's vision of pure thought has been replaced by the scientific method, which, based on both reason and experiment, allows us to discover the underlying realities of the world. Rational action in public and private life now requires a basis in both reason and empirical investigation, and it often requires a departure from the solipsistic world of our direct experience. This principle is a source of most of my own public activism in opposition to government policies based on ideology rather than evidence. And it is also probably why I respond so negatively to the concept of the sacred, implying as it does some idea or admonition that is off limits to public questioning, exploration, discussion, and sometimes ridicule. It is hard to state this view more strongly than I did in a New Yorker piece. Quote, "Whenever scientific claims are presented as unquestionable, they undermine science. Similarly, when religious actions or claims about sanctity can be made with impunity in our society, we undermine the basis of modern secular democracy. We owe it to ourselves and to our children not to give a free pass to governments, totalitarian, theocratic, or democratic, that endorse, encourage, enforce, or otherwise legitimize the suppression of open questioning in order to protect ideas that are considered sacred. 500 years of science have liberated humanity from the shackles of enforced ignorance." End quote. Philosophical reflections aside, the prime reason I am introducing Plato's cave here is that it can provide a concrete example of the nature of the scientific discoveries at the heart of the story I want to tell. Imagine a shadow that our prisoners might see on the wall, displayed by an evil puppeteer located on a ledge in front of the fire, presented in the provided PDF 1B. This shadow displays both length and directionality, two concepts that we, who are not confined to the cave, take for granted. However, as the prisoners watch, this shadow changes, as shown in the second example from figure 1B. Later, it looks like the third example from figure 1B. And again later, it looks like the fourth example from figure 1B, and later still, like the fifth example from figure 1B. What would the prisoners infer from all of this? Presumably, that concepts such as length or direction have no absolute meaning. The objects in their world can change both length and directionality arbitrarily. In the reality of their direct experience, neither length nor directionality appears to have significance. What will the natural philosopher who has escaped to the surface to explore the richer world beyond the shadows discover? He will see that the shadow is first of all just a shadow, a two-dimensional image on the wall cast from a real, three-dimensional object located behind the prisoners. He will see that the object has a fixed length that never changes, and that it's accompanied by an arrow that is always on the same side of the object. From a vantage point slightly above the object, he sees that the series of images results from the projection of a rotating weather vane on the wall, as shown in the PDF figure 1C. When he returns to join his former colleagues, the philosopher-scientist can explain that an absolute quantity called length doesn't change over time, and that directionality can be assigned unambiguously to certain objects as well. He will tell his friends that the real world is three-dimensional, not two-dimensional, and that once they understand, all of their confusion about the seemingly arbitrary changes will disappear. Would they believe him? It would be a tough sell because they won't have an intuitive idea of what a rotation is. After all, with an intuition based purely on two-dimensional experience, it would likely be difficult to picture, mentally, any rotations in a third dimension. Blank stares? Probably. The loony bin? Maybe. However, he might win over the community by stressing attractive characteristics associated with his claim. Behavior that on the surface appears to be complex and arbitrary can be shown to result from a much simpler underlying picture of nature, and seemingly disparate phenomena are actually connected and can be part of a unified whole. Better still, he could make predictions that his friends could test. First, he could argue that if the apparent change in the length of the shadows measured by the group is really due to a rotation in a third dimension, whenever the length of the object briefly vanishes, it will immediately reemerge with the arrow pointing in the opposite direction. Second, he could argue that as the length oscillates, the maximum length of the shadow when the arrow is pointing in one direction will always be exactly the same as the maximum length of the shadow when it is pointing in the other direction. Plato's cave thus becomes an allegory for far more than he may have intended. Plato's freed man discovers the hallmarks of the remarkable true story of our own struggle to understand nature on its most fundamental scales of space, time, and matter. We, too, have had to escape the shackles of our prior experience to uncover profound and beautiful simplifications and predictions that can be as terrifying as they are wonderful. But just as the light beyond Plato's cave is painful to the eyes at first, with time it becomes mesmerizing. And once witnessed, there is no going back. Chapter 2. Seeing in the dark. Let there be light, and there was light. Genesis, chapter 1, verse 3. In the beginning, there was light. It is no coincidence that the ancients imagined in Genesis that light was created on the first day. Without light, there would be little awareness of the vast universe surrounding us. When we nod and say, "I see," to a friend who's trying to explain something, we convey far more than just an observation, but rather a fundamental understanding. Plato's allegory was appropriately centered on light, light from a fire to cast the shadows in the cave wall, and light from the outside to temporarily blind the freed prisoner and then illuminate the real world for him. Like the prisoners in the cave, we too are prisoners of light. Almost everything we learn about the world, we learn from what we see. While the most significant words in the Western religious canon may be, "Let there be light," in the modern world, this phrase now has a completely different significance from what it once did. Human beings may be prisoners of light, but so is the universe. What once appeared as a whim of a Judeo-Christian god, or other gods before that one, we now understand to be required by the very laws that allow both heaven and, more important, earth to exist. You cannot have one without the other. Earth, or matter, follows light. This change in perception underlies almost every development in the edifice we call modern science. I am writing these words as I stare out from a ship at one of the Galapagos Islands, which Charles Darwin made famous, and which made him famous in return as he changed our perception of life and its diversity with a single brilliant realization that all living species develop through the natural selection of small inherited variations that are passed along to future generations by survivors. As surely as the understanding of evolution changed everything about our understanding of biology, our changing understanding of light changed everything about our physical understanding of our place in the universe. As a useful fringe benefit, this change resulted in virtually all of the technology on which the modern world is based. The extent to which our observations of the world imprison our minds and frame our description of the fabric of the universe remained unappreciated for more than 20 centuries following Plato. Once serious minds began to investigate in detail the hidden nature of the universe, it took over 4 centuries for them to fully resolve the question, what is light? Perhaps the most serious modern mind, though certainly not the first, to ask this question, was also one of the most famous and oddest scientists in history, Isaac Newton. It is not inappropriate to classify Newton as a modern mind. After all, his 17th century Principia, Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, uncovered the classical laws of motion and laid the basis for his theory of gravity, both of which form the foundation of much of modern physics. Nevertheless, as John Maynard Keynes pointed out, Newton was not the first of the Age of Reason. He was the last of the magicians, the last of the Babylonians and Sumerians, the last great mind that looked out on the visible and intellectual world with the same eyes as those who began to build our intellectual inheritance rather less than 10,000 years ago. The truth of this statement reflects the revolutionary importance of Newton's work. After the Principia, no rational person could view the world the same way as the ancients had viewed it. But it also reflects the character of Newton himself. He devoted far more time and far more ink to writing about the occult, alchemy, and searching for hidden meanings and codes in the Bible, focusing in particular on the book of Revelation and the mysteries associated with the ancient Temple of Solomon, than he did to writing about physics. Newton was also one in a long line of people, which extends before and after him, who felt that he had been specifically chosen by God to help reveal the true meaning of the scriptures. To what extent his studies of the universe derived from his fascination with the Bible is not clear, but it does seem reasonable to conclude that his primary interest was in theology, and that natural philosophy came in well below that, and probably below alchemy as well. Many individuals point to Newton's fascination with God as evidence of the compatibility between science and religion, and to assert that modern science owes its existence to Christianity. This confuses history with causality. It is undeniable that many of the early giants of modern Western natural philosophy from Newton onward were deeply religious, although Darwin lost much, if not all, of his religious belief later in life. But remember that during much of this period, there were primarily 2 sources of education and wealth, the church and the crown. The church was the national science foundation of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries. All institutions of higher learning were tied to various denominations, and it was unthinkable for any educated person to not be affiliated with the church. And, as Giordano Bruno and later Galileo discovered, it was unpleasant, at best, to counter its doctrine. It would have been remarkable for any of these leading early scientific thinkers to have been anything but religious. The religiosity of the early scientific pioneers is also cited today by sophists who claim that science and religious doctrine are compatible, but who confuse science and scientists. In spite of frequent appearances to the contrary, scientists are people. And like all people, they are capable of holding many potentially mutually contradictory notions in their head at the same time. No correlation between divergent views held by any individual is representative of anything but human foibles. To claim that some scientists are or were religious is like saying some scientists are Republicans, or some are flat earthers, or some are creationists. It doesn't imply causality or consistency. My friend Richard Dawkins has told me of a professor of astrophysics who, during the day, writes papers that are published in astronomical journals assuming that the universe is more than 13 billion years old, but then goes home and privately espouses the literal biblical claim that the universe is 6,000 years old. What determines intellectual consistency or lack thereof in the sciences is a combination of rational arguments with subsequent evidence and continued testing. It is perfectly reasonable to claim that religion in the Western world may be the mother of science. But as any parent knows, children rarely grow up to be the models of their parents. Newton may, following tradition, have been motivated to look at light because it was a gift from God. But we remember his work not because of his motivation, but because of what he discovered. Newton was convinced that light was made of particles, which he referred to as corpuscles, while Descartes, and later Newton's nemesis Robert Hooke, and still later the Dutch scientist Christian Huygens, all claimed that light was a wave. One of the key observations that appeared to support the wave theory was that white light, such as light from the sun, could split into all the colors of the rainbow when passed through a prism. As was often the case during his life, Newton believed that he was correct, and several of his most famous contemporaries and competitors were wrong. To demonstrate this, he devised a clever experiment using prisms that he first performed while at home in Woolsthorpe to escape the bubonic plague ravaging Cambridge. As he reported at the Royal Society in 1672, on the 44th try, he observed precisely what he hoped he would see. Advocates of the wave theory had argued that light waves were made of white light and that the light split into colors when it passed through the prism because of corruption of the rays as they traversed the glass. In this case, the more glass, the more splitting. Newton reasoned that this was not the case, but that light is made of colored particles that combine together to appear white. With a nod to his occult fascination, Newton classified the colored particles of the spectrum, a term he coined, into seven different types: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. From the time of the Greeks, the number seven had been considered to possess mystical qualities. To demonstrate that the wave corruption picture was incorrect, Newton passed a beam of white light through two prisms held in opposite orientations. The first prism split the light into its spectrum, and the second recomposed it back into a single white light beam. This result would have been impossible if the glass had corrupted the light. A second prism would have simply made the situation worse, and would not have caused the light to revert back to its original state. This result does not, in fact, disprove the wave theory of light. It actually supports it, because light slows down as it bends upon entering the prism, just as waves would do. But since the advocates of that theory had argued incorrectly that the spectral splitting was due to corruption, Newton's demonstration that this was not the case struck a significant blow in favor of his particle model. Newton went on to discover many other facets of light that we use today in our understanding of the wave nature of light. He showed that every color of light has a unique bend angle when passing through a glass prism. He also showed that all objects appear to be the same color as the color of the light beam illuminating them. And he showed that colored light will not change its color no matter how many times it is reflected by or passes through a prism. All of these results, including his original result, can be explained simply if white light is indeed composed of a collection of different colors. That much he got right. But they can't be explained if light is made of different colored particles. Rather, white light is composed of waves of many different wavelengths. Newton's opponents did not give up easily. Even in the face of Newton's rising popularity and the death of his chief opponent, Hooke, they did not give up even after Newton's election as president of the Royal Society in 1703, the year before he actually published his research on light in his epic Optics. Indeed, the debate on the nature of light continued to rage on for over a century. Part of the problem with a wave picture of light was the question, what is it that light is a wave of exactly? And if it is a wave, then since all known waves require some medium, what medium does it travel in? These questions were sufficiently perplexing that practitioners of the wave theory had to resurrect a new invisible substance permeating all space, the ether. The resolution of this conundrum came, as such resolutions often do, from a totally unexpected corner of the physical world, one full of sparks and spinning wheels. When I was a young professor at Yale, in the ancient but huge office I was lucky enough to commandeer when an equally ancient colleague retired, there was left hanging for me a copy of the photograph of Michael Faraday taken in 1861. I've treasured it ever since. I don't believe in hero worship, but if I did, Faraday would be up there with the best. Perhaps more than any other scientist of the 19th century, he is responsible for the technology that powers our current civilization. Yet he had little formal education, and at an age of 14 became a bookbinder's apprentice. Later in his career, after achieving world recognition for his scientific contributions, he insisted on keeping to his humble roots, turning down a knighthood and twice turning down the presidency of the Royal Society. Later on, he refused to advise the British government on the production of chemical weapons for use in the Crimean War, citing ethical reasons. And for more than 33 years, he gave a series of Christmas lectures at the Royal Institution to excite young people about science. What's not to like? Much as one might admire the man, it is the scientist who matters here for our story. Faraday's first scientific lesson is one I tell my students. Always suck up to your professors. At the age of 20, after completing 7 years of apprenticeship as a bookbinder, Faraday attended the lectures of the famous chemist Humphrey Davy, then the head of the Royal Institution. Afterward, Faraday presented Davy with a 300-page, beautifully bound book containing the notes Faraday had taken during the lectures. Within a year, Faraday was appointed Davy's secretary, and shortly thereafter got an appointment as chemical assistant in the Royal Institution. Later on, Faraday learned the same lesson, but with the opposite result. Following his excitement over some early, quite significant experiments that he performed, Faraday accidentally forgot to acknowledge work with Davy in his published results. This accidental snub probably resulted in his being reassigned to other activities by Davy and delaying his world-changing research by several years. When reassigned, Faraday had been working on the hot area of scientific research, the newly discovered connections between electricity and magnetism, driven by the results of the Danish physicist Hans Christian Ørsted. These two forces seem quite different, yet have odd similarities. Electric charges can attract or repel, so can magnets, yet magnets always seem to have two poles, north and south, which cannot be isolated, while electric charges can individually be positive or negative. For some time, scientists and natural philosophers had wondered if the two forces might have some hidden connection. And the first empirical clue came to Ørsted by accident. In 1820, while delivering a lecture, Ørsted saw that a compass needle was deflected when an electric current from a battery was switched on. A few months later, he followed up on this observation and discovered that a current of moving electric charges, which we now commonly call an electric current, produced a magnetic attraction that caused compass needles to point in a circle around the wire. He had blazed a new trail. Word spread quickly among scientists through the continent and across the English Channel. Moving electric charges produce a magnetic force. Could there be other connections? Could magnets in turn influence electric charges? Scientists searched for such a possibility without success. Davy and another colleague tried to build an electric motor based on the connection discovered by Ørsted, but failed. Faraday ultimately got a wire with a current in it to move around a magnet, which did form a crude sort of motor. It was this exciting development that he reported without citing Davy's name. Part of this was mere gamesmanship. No new fundamental phenomenon was being uncovered. Perhaps this was the rationale for one of my favorite, likely apocryphal, stories about Faraday. It is said that William Gladstone, later to be British Prime Minister, heard of Faraday's laboratory full of weird devices and asked in 1850 what the practical value of all this study into electricity was. Faraday was purported to have replied, "Why, sir, there is every probability that you will soon be able to tax it." Apocryphal or not, both great irony and truth are in that witty comeback. Curiosity-driven research may seem self-indulgent and far from the immediate public good. However, essentially all of our current quality of life, for people living in the first world at least, has arisen from the fruits of such research, including all the electrical power that drives almost every device we use. 2 years after Davy's death in 1829, and 6 years after Faraday had become director of the laboratory of the Royal Institution, he made the discovery that cemented his reputation as perhaps the greatest experimental physicist of the 19th century, magnetic induction. Since 1824, he had tried to see if magnetism could alter the current flowing in a nearby wire or otherwise produce some kind of electric force on charged particles. He primarily wanted to see if magnetism could induce electricity, just as Oersted had shown that electricity, and electric currents in particular, could produce magnetism. On October 28, 1831, Faraday recorded in his laboratory notebook a remarkable observation. While closing the switch to turn on a current in a wire wound around an iron ring to magnetize the iron, he noticed a current flow momentarily in another wire wrapped around the same iron ring. Clearly, the mere presence of a nearby magnet could not cause an electric current to flow in a wire, but turning the magnet on or off could. Subsequently, he showed that the same effect occurred if he moved a magnet near a wire. As the magnet came closer or moved away, a current would flow in the wire. Just as a moving charge created a magnet, somehow a moving magnet, or a magnet of changing strength, created an electric force in the nearby wire and produced a current. If the profound theoretical implications of this simple and surprising result are not immediately apparent, you can be forgiven because the implication is subtle, and it took the greatest theoretical mind of the 19th century to unravel it. To properly frame it, we need a concept that Faraday himself introduced. Faraday had little formal schooling and was largely self-taught, and thus was never comfortable with mathematics. In another probably apocryphal story, Faraday boasted of using a mathematical equation only one time in all of his publications. Certainly, he never described the important discovery of magnetic induction in mathematical terms. Because of his lack of comfort with formal mathematics, Faraday was forced to think in pictures to gain intuition about the physics behind his observations. As a result, he invented an idea that forms the cornerstone of all modern physics theory and resolved a conundrum that had puzzled Newton until the end of his days. Faraday asked himself, how does one electric charge know how to respond to the presence of another distant electric charge? The same question had been posed by Newton in terms of gravity, where he earlier wondered how the Earth knew to respond as it did to the gravitational pull of the sun. How was the gravitational force conveyed from one body to another? To this he gave his famous response, hypotheses non fingo, I frame no hypotheses, suggesting that he had worked out the force law of gravity and showed that his prediction matched observations, and that was good enough. Many of us physicists have subsequently used this defense when asked to explain various strange physics results, especially in quantum mechanics, where the mathematics works, but the physical picture often seems crazy. Faraday imagined that each electric charge would be surrounded by an electric field, which he could picture in his head. He saw the field as a bunch of lines emanating radially outward from the charge. The field lines would have arrows on them, pointing outward if the charge was positive, and inward if it was negative, as can be seen in the provided PDF 2A. He further imagined that the number of field lines increased as the magnitude of the charge increased, as can be seen in the provided PDF 2B. The utility of this mental picture was that Faraday could now intuitively understand both what would happen when another test charge was put near the first charge and why. Whenever I use the colloquial term why, I mean how. The test charge would feel the field of the first charge wherever the second charge was located, with the strength of the force being proportional to the number of field lines in the region, and the direction of the force being along the direction of the field lines. Thus, for example, the test charge in question would be pushed outward in the direction shown in the provided PDF, figure 2C. One can do more than this with Faraday's pictures. Imagine placing two charges near each other. Since field lines begin at a positive charge and end on a negative charge and can never cross, it is almost intuitive that the field lines in between two positive charges should appear to repel each other and be pushed apart, whereas between a positive and a negative charge, they should connect together, as is shown in the provided PDF 2D. Once again, if a test charge is placed anywhere near these two charges, it would feel a force in the direction of the field lines, with a strength proportional to the number of field lines in that region. Faraday thus pictured the nature of electric forces between particles in a way that would otherwise require solving the algebraic equations that describe electrical forces. What is most amazing about these pictures is that they capture the mathematics exactly, not merely approximately. A similar pictorial view could be applied to magnets and magnetic fields, reproducing the magnetic force law between magnets, experimentally verified by Coulomb, or current-carrying wires derived by André-Marie Ampère. Up until Faraday, all the heavy lifting in discovering the laws of electricity and magnetism was done by the French. Using these mental crutches, we can then re-express Faraday's discovery of magnetic induction as follows. An increase or decrease in the number of magnetic field lines going through a loop of wire will cause a current to flow in the wire. Faraday recognized quickly that his discovery would allow the conversion of mechanical power into electrical power. If a loop of wire was attached to a blade that was made to rotate by, say, a flow of water, such as a water wheel, and the whole thing was surrounded by a magnet, then as the blade turned, the number of magnetic field lines going through the wire would continuously change, and a current would continuously be generated in the wire. Voila, Niagara Falls, hydroelectricity, and the modern world. This alone might be good enough to cement Faraday's reputation as the greatest experimental physicist of the 19th century. But technology wasn't what motivated Faraday, which is why he stands so tall in my estimation. It was his deep sense of wonder and his eagerness to share his discoveries as broadly as possible that I admire most. I'm convinced that he would agree that the chief benefit of science lies in its impact in changing our fundamental understanding of our place in the cosmos. And ultimately, this is what he did. I cannot help but be reminded of another more recent great experimental physicist, Robert R. Wilson, who at the age of 29 was head of the research division at Los Alamos, which developed the atomic bomb during the Manhattan Project. Many years later, he was the first director of the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Batavia, Illinois. When Fermi Lab was being built in 1969, Wilson was summoned before Congress to defend the expenditure of significant funds on this exotic new accelerator, which was to study the fundamental interactions of elementary particles. Asked if it contributed to national security, which would have easily justified the expenditure in the eyes of the congressional committee members, he bravely said no. Rather, and I quote, "It only has to do with the respect with which we regard one another, the dignity of men, our love of culture. It has to do with, are we good painters, good sculptors, great poets? I mean, all the things that we really venerate and honor in our country and are patriotic about. In that sense, this new knowledge has all to do with honor and country, but it has nothing to do directly with defending our country, except to help make it worth defending." End of quote. Faraday's discoveries allowed us to power and create our civilization, to light up our cities and our streets, and to run our electric devices. It is hard to imagine any discovery that is more deeply ingrained in the workings of modern society. But more deeply, what makes his contribution to our story so remarkable is that he discovered a missing piece of the puzzle that changed the way we think about virtually everything in the physical world today, starting with light itself. If Newton was the last of the magicians, Faraday was the last of the modern scientists to live in the dark regarding light. After his work, the key to uncovering the true nature of our main window on the world lay in the open, waiting for the right person to find it. Within a decade, a young Scottish theoretical physicist, down on his luck, took the next step. Chapter 3. Through a Glass, Lightly. Nothing is too wonderful to be true, if it be consistent with the laws of nature. And in such things as these, experiment is the best test of such consistency. Faraday, Laboratory Journal Entry, number 10,040, March 18th, 1849. The greatest theoretical physicist of the 19th century, James Clerk Maxwell, whom Einstein would later compare to Newton for his impact on physics, was coincidentally born in the same year that Michael Faraday made his great experimental discovery of induction. Like Newton, Maxwell also began his scientific career fascinated by color and light. Newton had explored the spectrum of visible colors into which white light splits when traversing a prism, but Maxwell, while still a student, investigated the reverse question. What is the minimal combination of primary colors that would reproduce, for human perception, all the visible colors contained in white light? Using a collection of colored spinning tops, he demonstrated that essentially all colors we perceive can result from mixtures of red, green, and blue, a fact familiar to anyone who has plugged RGB cables into a color television. Maxwell used this realization to produce the world's first rudimentary color photograph. Later, he became fascinated with polarized light, which results from light waves whose electric and magnetic fields oscillate only in certain directions. He sandwiched blocks of gelatin between polarizing prisms and shined light through them. If the two prisms allowed only light to pass that was polarized in different perpendicular directions, then if one was placed behind the other, no light would make it through. However, if stresses were present in the gelatin, then the light could have its axis of polarization rotated as it passed through the material, so that some light might then make it through the second prism. By searching for such fringes of light passing through the second prism, Maxwell could explore for stresses in the material. This has become a useful tool today for exploring possible material stresses in complex structures. Even these ingenious experiments do not adequately represent the power of Maxwell's voracious intellect or his mathematical ability, which were both manifest at a remarkably early age. Tragically, Maxwell died at the age of 48 and had precious little time to accomplish all that he did. His inquisitive nature was reflected in a passage his mother added to a letter from his father to his sister-in-law when Maxwell was only 3. Quote, "He is a very happy man, and has improved much since the weather got moderate. He has great work with doors, locks, keys, etc. And show me how a doze is ever out of his mouth. He also investigates the hidden course of streams and bell wires, the way the water gets from the pond through the wall." End quote. After his mother's untimely death of stomach cancer, to which Maxwell would later succumb at the same age, his education was interrupted. But by the age of 13, he had hit his stride at the prestigious Edinburgh Academy, where he won the prize for mathematics, and also for English and poetry. He then published his first scientific paper concerning the properties of mathematical curves, which was presented at the Royal Society of Edinburgh when he was only 14. After this precocious start, Maxwell thrived at university. He graduated from Cambridge, becoming a fellow of the college within a year after graduation, which was far sooner than average for most graduates. He left shortly thereafter and returned to his native Scotland to take up a chair in natural philosophy in Aberdeen. At only 25, he was the head of a department and teaching 15 hours a week, plus an extra free lecture for a nearby college for working men, something that would be unheard of for a chaired professor today, and something that I find difficult to imagine doing myself and still having any energy left for research. Yet, Maxwell nevertheless found time to solve a problem that was 2 centuries old. How could Saturn's rings remain stable? He concluded that the rings must be made of small particles, which garnered him a major prize that had been set up to encourage an answer to this question. His theory was confirmed more than 100 years later, when Voyager provided the first close-up view of the planet. You would think that after this remarkable output, he would have been able to remain secure in his professorship. However, in 1860, the same year that he was awarded the Royal Society's prestigious Rumford Medal for his work on color, the college where he lectured merged with another college and had no room for 2 professors of natural philosophy. In what must surely go down in history as one of the dumbest academic decisions ever made, and that's a tough list to top, Maxwell was unceremoniously laid off. He tried to get a chair in Edinburgh, but again, the position was given to another candidate. Finally, he found a position down south, at King's College, London. One might expect Maxwell to have been depressed or disconsolate because of these developments, but if he was, his work reflected no signs of it. The next 5 years at King's were the most productive period in his life. During this time, he changed the world 4 times. The first 3 contributions were the development of the first light-fast color photograph, the development of the theory of how particles in a gas behave, which helped establish the foundations of the field now known as statistical mechanics, essential for understanding the properties of matter and radiation. And finally, his development of, quote, dimensional analysis, end quote, which is perhaps the tool most frequently used by modern physicists to establish deep relationships between physical quantities. I used it just last year, for example, with my colleague Frank Wilczek, to demonstrate a fundamental property of gravity relevant to understanding the creation of our universe. Each contribution on its own would have firmly established Maxwell among the greatest physicists of his day. However, his 4th contribution ultimately changed everything, including our notions of space and time. During his period at King's, Maxwell frequented the Royal Institution, where he came in contact with Michael Faraday, who was 40 years older, but still inspirational. Perhaps these meetings encouraged Maxwell to return his focus to the exciting developments in electricity and magnetism, a subject he had begun to investigate 5 years earlier. Maxwell used his considerable mathematical talents to describe and understand the phenomena explored by Faraday. He began by putting Faraday's hypothesized lines of force on a firmer mathematical footing, which allowed him to explore in more depth Faraday's discovery of induction. Over the 12 years between 1861 and 1873, Maxwell put the final touches on his greatest work, a complete theory of electricity and magnetism. To do this, Maxwell used Faraday's discovery as the key to revealing that the relationship between electricity and magnetism is symmetrical. Oersted and Faraday's experiments had shown simply that a current of moving charges produces a magnetic field, and that a changing magnetic field, produced by moving a magnet or simply turning on a current to produce a magnet, produces an electric field. Maxwell first expressed these results mathematically in 1861, but soon realized that his equations were incomplete. Magnetism appeared to be different from electricity. Moving charges create a magnetic field, but a magnetic field can create an electric field even without moving, just by changing. As Faraday discovered, turning on a current, which produces a changing magnetic field as the current ramps up, produces an electric